the numerous barrack enclosures in Aldershot and the outskirts. So we continued training there, just picked up where we had left off in Canada, but it was a step backwards because we were now back on a divisional signal basis. But within 2 or 3 months, I moved back with the 14th Field Regiment, and that then we started the semi-active, well, I guess you could call it an active role. It was part of the defense of the south coast of England against the possible invasion. So,
whereabouts were you stationed?
Gosh, I have to start thinking now. It was mainly in Sussex. At various times, we were near Guildford. Then we went into Surrey near Croydon, and then we moved further south to down near Worthing. So we became very familiar with the south of England, and this was, we were constantly doing exercises, but at the same time carrying out a stationary role in my signals section, manned permanent telephone exchanges, which were on the main military system, which was consisted of lines leased from the British post office, who run the telephone system in England. So we had a very definite role, and we had standing orders for certain types of alerts. We were to the regiment was to move into a standby area, and depending on where the invasion was taking place, we would move to certain predetermined spots, and we knew these spots. We knew exactly where to go and how to set up in these areas, and we used to practice this. Then we also did some shooting. There was a place in Wales, Sennybridge, which was comparable to what I described, Tracadie, where an area in the high hills of Wales had been cleared of people. There were very few there anyway. It was grim country, something like the highlands of Labrador. So we would do shoots there, but that there again we had communications problems. We were using some radio equipment which I think had been evacuated from Dunkirk, and it was constantly breaking down. The climate there is in the winter is terrible. It's rains and fog. Sometimes it was so foggy we just had to stop everything. And the radio sets were permeated with moisture and would short circuit. And on one occasion there was what they called a divisional shoot, when all three field regiments in the division were firing together. And the whole thing was a schmozzle because the communications broke down. And each evening, the brigadier, divisional artillery commander, would have a post-mortem in a theater in one of the towns, gather all the officers and senior NCOs, and point out what had gone wrong. It was excellent training. This man was he was a very miserable fellow. In fact, his own signal officer told me once that he didn't eat breakfast in the morning just so he could be really mean. But anyway, he decided that I was responsible for the breakdown of communications, which I was, I guess. And he pointed the finger at me. But I didn't feel guilty at all. All my radio sets kept breaking down, and there was no way to fix them. But it was shortly after that we began to get the modern equipment, which was excellent by standards in those days. Of course, this was long before printed circuits and solid-state electronics. It was tubes, and the operators became very adept at knowing immediately which tube had blown, and they had a little padded box with spares, and they could change tubes. So we started to have some good equipment.
Number 9 set?
We had number 9. The number 11 was the one that was mainly used in the artillery infantry brigade units. Although later on we did get a special, once we crossed over France, we did get a special number 9 link, which was an extra communication. The number 9 was a very powerful set, and they didn't like to use them too far forward because they could be picked up by the enemy more so than the others, although the others were too. So the number 11 was our mainstay.
What would be the range of that?
Well, the ground wave probably 10 or 15 miles, but God only knows what the sky wave did, probably across the Atlantic. It was a short wave. It wasn't a ultra short or a VHF. It was a short wave. I've forgotten what the frequencies were. But they were, one of the problems with the older sets, they would drift off frequency constantly, but the number 11 was a very stable set. And then later, we were issued with a number 22 set, which had a crystal control. And from then on, there was very little problem with drifting frequencies. But the operator could tell very quickly if his frequency was drifting, and he could correct. So it was a satisfactory set, and it was very rugged. You could drop the things. They'd been designed first for tanks, and they were found to be so good that they were adopted by the field units other than armored.
And around what time was it that you were selected to go to North Africa?
That was in about February 1943. The North African campaign had been launched during in the fall of 42, I believe, landings at Oran and Algiers, and it had gone very successfully. And as I mentioned the other day, because the Canadians were becoming restless, it was decided to select officers and NCOs to do a tour with British units, both in the 8th Army, which was in the desert of Libya, and with the 1st Army in North Africa. And I was selected to go to the 1st Army.
So that might have been because of your relationship with Brigadier?
Well, I often wondered that, although an officer who was very close to the colonel said no, it wasn't. But I was delighted at the thought, but it took a long time to get the posting, and finally it was, I think, April before I was posted. And I arrived in Algiers about the time that the fighting was nearly finished. The 1st Army were approaching Tunis from the west, and the 8th Army that had completely defeated the Africa Corps were moving up from the south, and the two were concentrating on Tunis. So I didn't see any fighting at all in North Africa. I was moved from one staging camp to another, and eventually it was posted to a British Corps signals at a place called Sousse, south of Tunis, But by then, the fighting was finished, and the troops were starting to train for the invasion of Sicily.
How was it like serving with the British? How would you compare it to the Canadian Army?
I would say that from the officer standpoint, now these were technical officers. Generally, they were probably better trained than the Canadians. And I had found out possibly why that was. Prior to going to North Africa, I was sent on a armored signals course in the south of England at a school which specialized in armored training. And I found that the instructors were the cream of the crop. The British seemed to pick their, that is, I'm talking only of technical now. I don't know what it was like in the fighting troops, but in technical matters, they picked their best people and sent them back to the training establishments. I had the impression that in the Canadian Army it was the opposite. The misfits were sent back to the training establishment. Now, I can't prove that, but I had that impression.
Was it more disciplined than the British?
Yes, a different type of discipline.
More formality?
More formal, yes. Canadian troops were not undisciplined, but they had a great deal more individual initiative, which showed. The British soldier is very amenable to strict orders and doing exactly as he's told. He's an excellent soldier. They're stubborn. They don't give up. The Canadian soldiers seem to have more individual initiative when they got into action. But anyway, getting back to this matter of the training school, this armored school was excellent, and I enjoyed every minute of it. But as far as being with the British with the signals in North Africa, I don't remember too much about it. These people had been through some pretty tough fighting, and it was like a holiday. The war for them was over for a few weeks, and they were taking things easy. And we were mainly doing training, but it's very hot. It's subtropical, that area, and it was the middle of the summer. And so we would start training at daybreak, 5 o'clock in the morning, and put in a solid day till about 1 o'clock, and then everybody had the afternoon off. And beautiful beaches at Sousse, warm Mediterranean water, nice clean beaches, and we'd spend the afternoon on the beach. So it was not a very onerous war. But by then things were starting to become very active in England in preparation for the invasion, and the 3rd Division had been selected as one of the assault divisions. In fact, we were the spearhead of the Canadian effort in Normandy, and so while I was away, all of the units in 3rd Division had started to be equipped with invasion equipment and doing exercises. And when I got back in, I guess it was August 43, I first went to a transit camp, a holding unit they called it. And very quickly, I had been promoted to captain in the meantime, and I was very quickly posted not to the artillery unit, but to the an infantry section, 7th Brigade, which consisted of three Western battalions, the Winnipeg Rifles, the Regina Rifles, and the Canadian Scottish. The brigadier was a man by the name of Churchill Mann, very brilliant and outgoing, amusing officer, who had had quite a successful career. He was a young man, who an RMC graduate, had been a cavalryman before the war, became a staff officer very early in the Second World War, and was the staff officer who was essentially the planner of the Dieppe raid as part of 2nd Division. Now, of course, anyone who had anything to do with the planning of the Dieppe raid was subject to a great deal of criticism since. I don't think you could criticize the man at his level because the decision had been made on a political basis and the troops had to do the best they could with it. And they made mistakes, but the mistakes may have been made at a higher level. It may be that he didn't have much to work with. But anyway, he wasn't punished or anything because the raid went sour. He was promoted and became a fighting brigade commander, and he was a dandy, and he was amusing to work with. I, as signals officer, you might say I was his communications advisor, and the first thing that happened when I was posted to that unit was preparation for a very large exercise with live ammunition and ships and landings on the south coast of England. And we did our planning in an underground headquarters that had been prepared probably at the outset of the war, just outside of Portsmouth. And we were underground for about 10 days planning this. And my role was to deploy my signals to match the plan of attack, allocate frequencies to various sets and so on. And so I learned to know this man very well.
You were almost a staff officer yourself back in
the almost, yes, yeah. At that stage. The other brigade officer that I learned to know and respect was a man by the name of Peter Bennett, who was the brigade major, and he was the brigade major, and a brigade is the senior staff officer, and he does all the detailed planning. He was excellent. But he said nothing to me for about 2 months, nothing outside of business. So I didn't know just where I stood, but actually I think we were pretty good friends eventually. Well, that went on just one series of exercises after the other, each one becoming a little more realistic. We eventually made the contacts and started working with the actual ships that would carry the brigade overseas, across the channel. And we became familiar with the ships and also with the ship's officers. So it was a real team effort. The planning that preceded the invasion was remarkable. You often visualize military people as being bumbling to some effect, to some extent, but this was certainly not the case. And of course, today, when you read some of the books that that could not have been published because of security restrictions, which lasted about 30 years, you can see why it was such an efficient planning organization, because those people were all, in civilian life, were all top rate, outstanding people, scientists, planners, So the thing was planned right down to the last comma.
Security was
but
very
with tight. Provisions, with provisions for changes as things move. You can see the date was changed from overnight. So that was a very interesting period. Mann was moved on to a senior staff position, I think, in one of the corps. I don't remember, but he was replaced by another brigadier I became very fond of, Harry Foster. Harry Foster was the officer who had taken that force out of Vancouver to the Aleutians in, I think, 1943, which had been a, there were real problems there, because I remember some of the troops didn't want to go. I think there were deserters and so on. But anyway, he had a very firm man, a very approachable man, too. And he remained with us through the invasion, through the last days of the training and preparation, and through the invasion, and until we had until the fall of Falaise. Thereafter, he was promoted major general and commanded the 4th Division from then on until the end of the war.
Where did you move to once all the planning for the invasion?
We spent about 3 months on the Isle of Wight.
Doing the planning?
Yes. And then in the month prior to the invasion, we moved back into a concentration area just north of Southampton. And there were, these concentration areas were located all over the south and east of England, so that each unit would move to its designated seaport without confusion, without this sort of thing. This was another preparatory plan which worked extremely well. So we were able to move straight down to our ships in Southampton and Portsmouth without cross traffic. It was a matter of, I think, half an hour driving at 20 miles an hour to get to the port.
Like in the concentration area, there was a month of doing very little.
That's right. It was a bit the feeling you have when your classes are finished and you're waiting for the final exam. It was early summer, and it was a beautiful early summer, as it can be beautiful in England. And it was warm and sunny, and people were relaxed. And what was tremendous was the equipment pouring in. New vehicles, new radios, new everything. And it was an embarrassment of plenty, you might say. In fact, in the last day or two before we loaded, I had people from the stores coming to me and asking me if I couldn't load some extra radio sets in some of my vehicles, because they had so many that their stores were overcrowded. And so I actually took off with about twice as many wireless sets as were on my establishment. Completely irregular, but I had them. And it served me in good stead. Well, it served the division in good stead, because within days of landing, there had been so many tanks demolished or damaged and trucks blown up that units, tank units and other units, heard of the fact that I had extra sets, and they would come to me and I would give them to them. I had no use for it.
Okay, let's talk about day. Maybe you could take me through your whole day and tell me what I would have seen had I been in your shoes.
The first thing you would have seen, you would have been sleeping in a passageway on board a frigate, and suddenly a clatter of people rushing past you, and it turned out to be men coming up a ladder, as they call it in the Navy, a staircase right beside your bunk, carrying ammunition up to the guns on the deck. That was the first sign. Then a lot of heavy gunfire, airplanes flying over, bombers. Some of them were actually planes with paratroopers, bombers. And then there were two battleships plus some cruisers who started softening up the beaches. And then I guess about daybreak we were hauled out and went into standby positions. We had on board the ship permanent transmitters that were on our frequencies that I was responsible for. And once the first landing craft took off from their troop ships, which was about daybreak, then the communications opened up between my ship, which was the brigade headquarters, and the various landing craft, which contained the battalion commanders who had some signalmen with them, and they were part of my signals. So that little network started to work before landings, and the first landings were, you may know that better than I did, I think it was around 6 o'clock in the morning. And just about that time, we stood by to leave the ship. And then the control of the communications was, it was still on the ship, but I had other sets that were in what was called baby carriages. They were small two-wheeled carts with the radios on them. And these were tuned onto the same frequency as the control ship's sets. And then the brigade major stayed behind, I think. The brigadier and the staff captain and myself, the intelligence officer, and signalman. We had some who had these number 11 sets on these carriages, but we also had another network of what we called in those days walkie-talkies. But a walkie-talkie in those days was about 12 inches wide and about 18 inches high, and it was on a man's back. But they were a new development for us. They were an FM set, so the communications was much more reliable. So we loaded onto a motor torpedo boat, came alongside, and headed in. And when we got about, I guess we must have been about 3 miles offshore.
We haven't mentioned which beach it was.
It was, I'll have to check that. Juno or Gold. It was Kursaal. We were on the outskirts of Kursaal. There's your mayor. On this one. Juno Beach. Yes. And we went in some distance and then transferred again onto an LCA, the small landing craft that the infantry used, and we went right into the beach. By then, things had cooled off on the beach. The heavy shooting was finished, and the beach was becoming established. There was a casualty station with a few wounded. There were a few dead Germans laying around. And some of the assault tanks had actually moved in. And so we had an immediate objective, which was in about a mile. And at that time, we took over control from the ship. The ship sets were shut down. And so the brigade headquarters, this little advance headquarters, moved in behind the two assault battalions, the Winnipeg Rifles and the Regina Rifles. And we established ourselves in a small village, just in, I guess it was Gracer or Mayor. It was rather interesting. At that stage, we were walking down the road, and we came to there was a tank that was stopped by the road, one of the, there were actually Churchill tanks that had been used in the assault for, they were what they called specials. They carried bridges and various other things. One of them had attempted to lay its bridge across a small stream, and the bridge wasn't quite long enough, and when the tank rolled over it, the whole thing went down. So, and there it was on the bottom of the creek, and the next one had laid its bridge on top of it. And they'd crossed over it, and they were stopped by the side of the road waiting for orders when a sniper opened up on us in a church. And this was typical of, these were British tanks. The tank commander, who was a sergeant, was under the tank brewing a cup of tea. And so we said to him, we would like you to take on that sniper, which he did. He telephoned the gunner. There was a phone on the outside of the tank. See, he had got out for some reason, maybe to make the tea. And so he telephoned the gunner, who swung the turret around and opened up on the church tower and silenced that very quickly. Oh, anyway, we went on, and that was the first step. And then the reserve battalion.